The next case of the morning is number 044294, Dupuy against Samuels.
May it please the court. My name is Eric Light. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent Brian Samuels, the defendant appellant, the director of the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services.
Mr. Light, just so that you can structure your argument as you care to, I would appreciate at some point your discussing the jurisdictional issue with respect to this court's appellate jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. There is jurisdiction in this case under the collateral order doctrine. Normally, awards of interim attorney's fees are not immediately appealable, but there is an exception when there is a danger that the party who is ordered to pay attorney's fees may not get those back. And in this case, it's clear from what the defendants have, what the plaintiffs have said to the district court that there is a danger that they won't get the money back if indeed the defendant prevails at the end of the litigation. So there's
what precisely did are those representations that you believe place this case in that category?
Well, they said that the plaintiff's attorneys were in a situation of financial urgency, that the lead counsel may not be able to maintain their law practice through the end of 2005, I believe, without this award of attorney's fees. They emphasized the small nature of their practice, that they'd been litigating for 8 years without compensation. So I don't think there's any question in this case compared to other cases where this court has found a danger of money not being returned, that this case satisfies, rises to an equal level as those cases.
Did the district court make any findings in this respect?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
No, she discussed it, but I couldn't find in any place where the district court made any explicit findings.
Right. I don't recall any either, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes.
Well, would there have been some reason then to award the interim $1 million because of, well, dire need, I guess? In coming up with the $1 million, she considered that less than what would ultimately be owed, right?
Well, she seemed to. I think she was moved by the representations that they had a great need for the money, and that
it's been going on a long time,
right?
And theoretically, without anything more, it's supposedly over $3 million run up in attorney's fees. Most businesses or firms or whatever can't exist with that kind of a non-payment if you continue to work. So I guess, follow-up Judge Ripple's, just to what extent are we focusing on the dire need of this firm? Because your concern is if you ultimately win with a permanent injunction that they have to pay that $1 million back and won't be able to. Is that right?
Right, exactly. I don't think this court In terms of, are you talking in terms of the merits? I don't think this court can focus on whether or not there's a dire need for the attorney's fees. In terms of whether or not there's jurisdiction, that is very much relevant.
That seems to be the only hook you have for jurisdiction, is that there's, the reason we're up here now concerned whether or not this $1 million should be paid is because you won't get it back.
Exactly. Essentially, the plaintiffs, they've never contested either in the district court or in their briefs on appeal that there is any substantial likelihood that they will be able to repay this money. And one would think that if there was such a substantial likelihood, they would have argued that to this court. Instead, what their argument boils down to is that that the director's appeal is frivolous.
Well, it boils down down to is they think they can't lose.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What it boils down to is they think they can't lose on merits.
Exactly. So they're not claiming that they're not even suggesting to this court seriously that they'll be able to pay the money. And I think under this court's cases, where it says that just the fact that there was a danger of it not being repaid, that's enough to invoke the collateral order doctrine with respect in cases of awards of interim attorney's fees.
Of course, if we have jurisdiction, then the determination is whether or not they've already succeeded sufficiently to at least keep the $1 million.
Correct. In this case, the issue is whether a district court may award attorney's fees under Section 1988 in the middle of the litigation before finally resolving the merits of even one claim of the plaintiffs, and where the defendant still retains the right to pursue judgment in his favor. The court held that under Section 1988, these plaintiffs were prevailing parties based solely on the entry of a preliminary injunction. This decision is troublesome for several reasons. First, as I noted, DCFS is highly unlikely to be able to get the money back if, at the end of the case, it were to prevail. In addition, on a broader level, the inevitable effect of the district court's decision is more interlocutory appeals. Because any time a defendant is subjected to a preliminary injunction, under the district court's theory anyway, they'll have a strong incentive to dispute that preliminary injunction if for no other reason than to deny the plaintiff's prevailing party status, even if they're entirely willing to live with the preliminary injunction pending a full determination on the merits at trial. They'll have a financial incentive to dispute the preliminary injunction, thereby creating more interlocutory appeals. And indeed, the district court's approach will encourage plaintiffs to move for preliminary injunctions in the first place, because preliminary injunctions offer a lower standard of proof, and if the district court is correct, it allows them to obtain attorney's fees, substantial attorney's fees. Good news is that this state of affairs is not required by the law. Section 1988's prevailing party requirement has three components. One, there must be a judicially sanctioned change in the legal relationship of the parties. Second, the plaintiffs must prevail on the merits of at least one of their claims. And third, the relief on the merits cannot be defeasible by further proceedings prior to final judgment. The second and third requirements are the key ones here. The prevailing on the merits of their claim, that factor derives from the plain language of Section 1988 and the legislative history. In construing the statutory term prevailing party, the Supreme Court in Buchanan said that respect for ordinary language requires that a plaintiff receive at least some of the relief on the merits of his claim before he can be said to be a prevailing party. In reviewing the legislative history of Section 1988, specifically in regard to the availability of interim attorney's fees, the Supreme Court in Hanrahan said that it concluded that Congress intended to permit the interim award of counsel fees only when a party has prevailed on the merits of at least some of his claims. The court in Hanrahan also summarized the types of cases where Congress thought an award of interim attorney's fees was appropriate. It described these cases as cases where a party to whom fees are to be awarded establishes the liability of the opposing party with only the final relief remaining to be determined. A corollary to all this, of course, is that the relief that the plaintiff receives must not be defeasible by further proceedings. In other words, it must be a final determination of the merits, not of all claims of the plaintiff, but at least of one of the claims of the plaintiff. A tentative determination is not enough, and indeed the Fourth Circuit in Smith versus University of North Carolina has put it nicely. It said, to prevail, a party must establish in an enduring way that he or she was right. The test is whether or not there was a final disposition in favor of the party claiming that it prevailed. These requirements further the basic purpose of Section 1988. The purpose is to compensate those who vindicate constitutional or civil rights. Here, where there's a preliminary injunction, rights are not vindicated because it's not a final determination on the merits.
Well, aren't there some terms, I realize there's no final judgment at all, but I guess your claim is going to be that we're going to do a lot of this stuff anyway, or we did it independently, therefore it wasn't under court order, was it because of this case, I guess. Because there have been certainly changes.
That's correct.
There is a change in the relationship. So I guess that's what you're going to argue, say that can't be taken into consideration when if we were to determine we had jurisdiction and then look at that $1 million as at least that much being earned. Because these things are still, what, temporary or not mandated by the court?
Well, some of it has been mandated by the court, yes. But some of it was already in place before the court issued its preliminary injunction order. For example, the 90-day rule. When this case started out, the agency had no time limit on which it could, which it was required to issue a final administrative decision. Before the preliminary injunction hearing, the agency announced to the district court that it was going to initiate the process of changing its rules to require a 90-day time limit for instituting. For rendering an administrative decision. And that rule was changed in June of 2000 before the district court issued its memorandum of opinion and order in March of 2001 on the preliminary injunction motion, and well before the 2003 preliminary injunction order. So that's one change that occurred independently of the district court's order. In addition, the director changed his rules on what notices were required for parties who were subject of indicated findings. And similarly, those rules, the process for changing those rules began before the preliminary injunction ruling. So some of this was already in the works before the court ruled. And for other things, such as the credible evidence standard, as I've pointed out in the brief, there is substantial evidence presented at the preliminary injunction hearing that DCFS was always in compliance, at least substantial compliance, with its own rule. Basically, what the district court found was that in some cases, investigators were not considering exculpatory evidence. That's a preliminary determination on a preliminary injunction, and it's open to further revision at trial. And there's no reason that the department should not be afforded the opportunity to present its case on that issue at a full trial on the merits. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Light. We'll hear now from Mr. Felt. Mr. Feldman, again, I would appreciate your views on the matter of appellate jurisdiction at some point in your presentation.
Yes, Your Honor, I was planning on addressing that. May it please the Court, my name is Edward Feldman. I represent the plaintiffs. Mr. Light stated that the purpose of Section 1988 is to vindicate constitutional or civil rights, and that is exactly what has happened in this case up until this point. The problem at the core of the case, remember, and I know this court is familiar with the case, having just issued an opinion 4 months ago, innocent child care workers were losing their jobs. They were being branded as child abusers or child neglectors on the basis of very skimpy evidence. And in order to clear their names, they had no pre-deprivation process and had to wait sometimes many months or several years in order to be able to resume their careers. The district court heard 18 days of trial. There was extensive discovery, evidence presented, and declared in an opinion that this court later affirmed that the system was broken. Now, Judge Pallmeyer is now supervising an extensive remedial process that is designed for DCFS to fix that system under the court's supervision, and the preliminary injunction was the first step in that. And the court 4 months ago affirmed this sweeping mandatory preliminary injunction that was not a mere status quo order. This affected changes and altered the legal relationship between the parties. And the court went beyond that and in one respect expanded the class of persons entitled to the 35-day expedited relief through the administrator conference. So under the district court's order affirmed on appeal, these changes occurred. DCFS had to meet what they themselves call a heightened evidentiary burden before they can indicate child care workers and place them on the register. They have to provide additional pre-deprivation process in the form of an administrator's conference. They have to provide expedited appeals, not merely the 90 days that they said they were going to promulgate a rule before the hearing. They promulgated a rule after the hearing, but they had to go beyond that. First of all, they had to comply with the rule. They had a 30-day rule before. They had a 30-day rule on paper that said that hearings were supposed to occur within 30 days, and the ALJs were routinely giving themselves continuances, and that's why the system took many months or years. So Judge Pallmeyer decided, and this is in her opinion, this has to be enforced through the power of contempt. You can't merely have a 90-day rule. You have to implement it and comply with it. And the power of contempt is behind that. And for most of the child care workers, you can't give merely 90 days before you render a decision. You have to do that within 35 days. And that was the only issue they appealed from the past preliminary, when this was before the court before. And this court found that that was a proper exercise of the district court's discretion. Mr. Light says they voluntarily changed one notice. But when you read the district court's injunction and her opinion, there were numerous notices that had to be revised, not merely the one that they decided on their own. And she supervised an extensive process after finding that the notices were unconstitutional. People were not being given adequate notice before being wiped out of their careers. They were not being given adequate notice of their rights. And she supervised a process by which several notices have been rewritten. So it's not merely one notice. And it goes beyond that. The injunction requires DCFS to stop redacting the investigative files before turning them over, at least redacting them to the extent they were. Certain redactions are permitted, but they now must disclose much more data from the investigative files to permit the employees to defend their good names when they request a review. And they were not expunging people from the register who had already been exonerated. And the district court found that that was improper as well. If someone's been exonerated, you can't keep them on the register. They have to be expunged. As I said, DCFS only appealed one limited aspect of this order. And moreover, they vigorously defended, in the prior appeal, they vigorously defended this injunction as a proper exercise of the district court's discretion. And now for the past 2 years since the injunction has been in effect, and for the foreseeable future, numerous members of the plaintiff's class are receiving the benefits of that injunction. And no one can take that away. That is not defeasible. They're getting the notices. Unredacted files have to be turned over. Expedited appeals have to be given. The proper credible evidence standard has to be employed.
You're saying that's irreversible?
Every person who's gotten that has gotten that.
I don't mean the interim benefits. I mean the process. Is that a permanent process as far as you're concerned?
Yes.
Preliminary injunction notwithstanding.
Yes, both as a – the district court, of course, in the fee order that's now on this appeal, declared her view that it was effectively permanent. And they're not saying that they're going to go back to a lower credible evidence standard. They're not saying we're going to wipe out the 90-day rule. They're not saying let's tear up the notices and go back to the bad old days of no notices. They're not saying we're going to start giving them fully redacted files again. Those changes have been implemented. They're required by judicial order, and that's not, both as a practical and a legal matter, that's not going to go away. And as Judge Manning, as you mentioned earlier, plaintiff's counsel have now gone 8 years without a penny of compensation for their enormous efforts. More than 7 months ago now, the district court ordered an immediate payment of a portion of the fees that they're ultimately seeking, $1 million, and DCFS has yet to comply with that order. So the primary question on appeal is whether plaintiffs indeed became prevailing parties when the district court entered the mandatory injunction. We respectfully submit that Judge Pallmeyer's ruling that the agency violated the due process clause, that a remedy had to be put in place, and a remedy was put in place, whether she was correct in finding that the plaintiffs are prevailing parties, and we submit that she is. And that now gets us to the jurisdictional question. And, of course, the jurisdictional question is intertwined with the merits, and that is why I gave a summary leading up to this before answering the jurisdictional question directly, because the two have to be considered together. Under the case law that we've cited, of course, the normal rule is that an interim interlocutory appeal on an interim fee award is not normally something that gives the court jurisdiction. There is an exception to that rule if there is a substantial risk that the money, if ever taken away, would not be repaid if the order was ultimately reversed. And what we've presented in the papers is that substantial risk of non-repayment necessarily contains two elements. One is whether the plaintiff's counsel have the financial wherewithal, if it's ever wiped out, of repaying the money. And on that, we've stated there is a risk that that could not be repaid. The financial wherewithal is an issue. But there's also the substantial risk test also requires the court to look at whether there's really a substantial risk that the money would ever have to be repaid. And in this case, we've
so said, at an educated guess that you're going to win.
Well, I'm never.
Well, isn't
I've been wrong before, Your Honor.
Well, that's the predicate for the argument. It's an educated guess that you're going to win in the long run.
Yes, and the district court, I think, made the educated guess more than at least reasonable by entering the $1 million fee award.
She's the one in charge of it at that stage of the game. That,
she is.
It becomes a little more than an educated guess. It becomes a foregone conclusion.
It's clear in her mind that this injunction, at least some of it, is here to stay.
Which means that any further hearing is a waste of time.
Any further hearing
would be a waste of time.
And I'm not
on the permanent injunction aspect of it.
Not that it would be a waste of time. I think what
we just solidify our views as already established.
No, I think what remains for a preliminary injunction, as I said, she's supervising a process.
I understand.
So maybe some of the injunction will be changed, some will be modified. But even Mr. Light's argument, they went through an extended discussion in their brief about several arguments that maybe on remand they might make certain arguments and maybe they'll prevail on some of those arguments. They haven't attacked much of what is in the injunction. They've said maybe we'll attack the credible evidence standard and maybe the judge will change her mind on the credible evidence standard. But what about the notices? He mentioned one notice, but there was a whole range, as I said, of notices that have been fixed, and those aren't going to be changed. They haven't even speculated that they're going to attack that. What about the 90-day and 35-day rule? They've said, well, maybe the 35-day rule won't work, but the 90-day rule, she ordered them for the reasons I said earlier, that they have to do it because they weren't doing it, even though they said they were going to pass a rule. They had to comply with it. They're not saying that that 90-day rule is going to go away. The redacted files, they haven't even speculated that they're going to attack the redacted files. So much of the injunction, not even in their speculative argument in their brief, much of the injunction is here to stay. Now, I should point out that, as we stated in our briefs, that entire line of argument about what might happen on remand, that maybe they're going to go to the district court and maybe they're going to persuade her that some of the injunction should be taken away, they did not argue that to the district court in their opposition to the fee motion. They didn't say a peep about any of that. They simply took the position, the bright line position, you can never get fees.
Has this case been marked for hearing for the preliminary, for the permanent injunction?
Pardon?
Is it been marked for trial for the permanent injunction proceedings?
No, but in fact today there is a conference this afternoon scheduled with the district court.
The answer is no.
There's no trial date, but there is a conference set with the district court today to talk about the process to get to a final remedial order, not only in Dupuy 1 but Dupuy 2, where she 2 months ago entered an opinion stating that plaintiffs are entitled to injunctive relief in Dupuy 2 as well. As I was saying, their argument in the court below was simply that you can never get fees on a preliminary injunction. And that quite clearly is not correct. And I just want to, before closing, summarize the legal standard that applies here. And that's expressed in this court's Baylark versus City of Chicago opinion from 1996, which drew on the Supreme Court precedents of Hensley and Garland. Quote, if the plaintiff has succeeded on any significant issue in the litigation which achieves some of the benefit the parties sought in bringing the suit, the plaintiff has crossed the threshold to a fee award of some kind. And in the Palmetto Properties case just last year, this court interpreting Buchanan stated that the Buchanan court, quote, held that in order to be a prevailing party, a litigant must have obtained a judgment on the merits, a consent decree, or some other judicially sanctioned change in the legal relationship of the parties. And finally, the Hanrahan case, Supreme Court case, Garland, and the Baylark case clearly state that interim fees can be awarded while litigation is pending. A final judgment is not necessary. Hanrahan says, as long as you establish your entitlement to some relief, and we've done that, you're entitled to fees, quote, although final remedial orders had not been entered. So under the Baylark and Palmetto cases and the Supreme Court precedent, there's essentially three elements: success on some issue in the litigation, achieving some of the benefits sought, and a judicially sanctioned change in the legal relationship of the parties. And all three of those elements are met here. Have plaintiffs succeeded on a significant issue? This court's opinion rendered 4 months ago, and just re-reviewing the district court's judgment, clearly plaintiffs have succeeded. The court unequivocally found, and this was affirmed, that there were constitutional violations. Workers were being thrown out of their jobs without adequate process. And that process is being fixed now. Element two, the plaintiffs achieved some of the benefit they sought. They sought process, additional process, and they've gotten additional process. The notices have been rewritten, the heightened credible evidence standard, et cetera. And has there been a judicially sanctioned change in the legal relationship of the parties? There has been an injunction that came up on appeal that they didn't even bother to challenge. They didn't even bother to challenge 95% of that injunction. They chose to live with it. They didn't even argue to this court, we are not constitutional violators. And in their brief, what they say is, well, we're now complying. We are now complying with the injunction, and therefore, maybe there won't be a permanent injunction. Well, they better be complying with the injunction. If they're not complying with the injunction, they're in contempt. You can't come into court and say, well, I was found to violate the Constitution. I was ordered to comply with the Constitution. I'm now complying, and therefore I win. No. When that happens, the plaintiff wins. That's precisely what Section 1988 is all about. To bring a constitutional violator to justice and to get relief to remedy the violation. And if the state is fully compliant with the remedy, then that's what this is all about. That's what plaintiffs have achieved, and that is why they are entitled to a fee. Thank you. We ask that the court affirm and direct that the interim fee award be paid forthwith.
Thank you, Mr. Felder. Mr. Light, you have 2 minutes.
Basically, the plaintiffs admit that there's a danger that they will not be able to repay the money. That's enough to satisfy the collateral order doctrine. No case has held that in considering the collateral order doctrine that the court is to also consider the likelihood of the appellant's success on appeal. No case says that. The plaintiffs talk about everything that the preliminary injunction order required the state to do. It is clear, however, there's been no trial date set. There's been no discovery cutoff date set, even for the issues addressed in the preliminary injunction order. There's been no date set for the filing of dispositive motions. This case is it's basically in the middle of the case right here. The preliminary injunction order, although extensive and although the district court talked about the merits, it was not a determination on the merits of the case. That's why you have a trial. That's why you have dispositive motions, as a summary judgment. Basically, the plaintiffs prevailed on a lower standard of proof here. In order to prevail on a preliminary injunction, all they have to show is a likelihood of success on appeal, not that they have succeeded on appeal. And indeed, the federal rules provide a procedure whereby the court can rule on the merits of the case at the preliminary injunction stage. Rule 65A2 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure provides a mechanism for doing what they apparently think that the district court did. But before the court can advance the hearing on the merits for the trial and consolidate it with the hearing on the preliminary injunction, the court must give notice to the parties and an opportunity to object. They did not move to consolidate the hearing on the trial with the hearing on the preliminary injunction, and the court did not purport to do so.
Mr. Feldman suggests that the argument you made before this court with respect to the arguments you might make in the district court at trial have not yet been disclosed and were not disclosed to the district court during the proceedings on the fee. Is that correct?
The state did not list the specific arguments. For example, we did not say that, oh, we're going to challenge the credible evidence standard. What the state said to the district court was, this was a preliminary injunction. The merits have not been resolved. They're open for ultimate resolution. Inherent in that statement is that the state has some arguments to make. If the state doesn't have any arguments to make, obviously the merits don't remain open for determination. So these are just illustrations of that larger point, Your Honor. I see that my time is up. Ask the court to reverse the entry of the $1 million interim attorney's fee award. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Light. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in this case for the briefs that were submitted, which were in both sides extremely good, and also for the very fine oral arguments today.